This recording is provided for personal, non-commercial use only. The songs in this recording are copyright Arnold Johnson. They are derived from songs by Jacques Brel. The two short stories and presentations are by Luc Baudouin. For more information, please visit cogsest.com.
And now I have the great pleasure of introducing our speaker this morning, Luc Baudouin. Luc is a member of Beacon, a familiar face to most of us, and the author of his newly published book, Cognitive Productivity, The Art and Science of Using Knowledge to Become Profoundly Effective. Some material from today's talk is drawn from his book and research on cognition and emotion. Luc holds a PhD in cognitive science from the University of Birmingham in the UK. He is president of CogZest, a training enterprise. He is also an adjunct professor of education at Simon Fraser University, where he runs the Cognitive Productivity Research Project. He is about to launch a new company called CogSci Apps Corporation. It will sell software to help people fall asleep and other software. I don't think that's going to happen with the service this morning. There will be recommended readings and notes for today's service will be posted on his website, cogzest.com. Welcome, Luc. And now I would like to invite all the children, the young at heart, to come and hear the story that Luc himself has written.
Okay, so Luc wrote the story, so the pictures for the story are what we can make in our minds, okay? Jackie Bright was a happy 11-year-old girl. She liked a kind boy named Max Bell, who was wise beyond his years. Max was an amateur mind mechanic, someone who knows how to help people deal with their feelings. Max explained to Jackie that our brains contain a feeling machine. This is the part of the brain that makes us feel hungry, thirsty, excited, sad, happy, angry, all those emotional feelings. A boy called Kramer lived in their neighborhood. Kramer's parents yelled at him a lot, and this upset Kramer's feeling machine. Unfortunately, Kramer tried to deal with his feeling machine by being mean to other kids. So one day, Jackie was merrily walking to school with her friends and Kramer, and Kramer boasted that he had recently taken $10 from his father. Jackie's feeling machine did not want to be outdone. So Jackie made up a juicy story. She told him that she had stolen apples from the local apple farm. On their way back from school, Kramer stopped Jackie. Kramer told her that he would tell the farmer that she was the one who'd been stealing apples from his farm. Jackie was terrified. She might go to jail because of her story. But she didn't want Kramer and her friends to know that she'd made up a silly story. Kramer told her that she would have to carry his school bag. Otherwise, he would tell the farmer. Jackie was afraid, so unfortunately, she did what he told her. Every time Kramer would see Jackie on their way to or from school, he would get Jackie to carry his school bag for him. Jackie was very distressed by this. So one day, Max walked up to her and he said,
Jackie, you're afraid of Kramer, aren't you?
Jackie was surprised and she said, yes.
You know that means that when you think of Kramer, your feeling machine gets all agitated, right?
Yeah.
You don't like feeling afraid, do you, Jackie?
No, I really don't.
So to avoid that fear, that emotion, you do what Kramer tells you to do, like carry his bag, don't you?
Yes.
Well, there's an easy solution to your problem, Jackie. Instead of trying to avoid feeling afraid, you could just accept your fear. Just observe where you feel it in your body. You don't need to like your fear, but you don't need to fight it either. When you accept your fear of Kramer, you can do what's right, and that's not carrying Kramer's school bag.
So the next time Kramer told Jackie to carry a school bag for him, Jackie told Kramer, Kramer, I'm afraid that you might tell the farmer, I didn't even really steal any apples from the farmer, so I'm just going to live with that fear because I'm not going to do what you tell me anymore. Now leave me alone. Jackie accepted her fear for several days, and then you know what happened to her fear? It got smaller and smaller and smaller, and it kind of disappeared. Jackie was very grateful that Max had taught her this lesson. Jackie thought a lot about her friend Max, but one day Max told her that he and his dad were moving back to London, Ontario. Jackie started to cry. She was going to miss him terribly. Max said,
"My feeling machine is rattling me too, Jackie. I'm very sad, but you know what we're going to have to do, don't you?"
Jackie said, "Yes, I know, Max. We cannot control our feelings, so we're going to have to accept our sadness, and we'll observe how it feels."
"That's right, Jackie. We won't be able to see each other for a long time. We can't control our feeling machines, but we can control what we do with our situation. So what do you propose we do?"
"Well, how about we write to each other once in a while?"
"Yeah, that's a good solution to our problem. Let's do that. We can be apart and still be good friends."
That's the story.
"The human mind is susceptible to perturbance, which is an aspect of emotion. You experience perturbance when an insistent motivator tends to disrupt your attention, making it hard for you to focus on something else. In fear, one might insistently long for safety. In anger, one might experience insistent desire for reparations. As a device for our reflection on emotions today, let's have a little story, if not now. On a journalistic assignment in the city of Ghent, Belgium, Bruges reporter Léo Lebel encounters the brilliant, beautiful, mystical Marieke. He falls head over heels in love with her, and she with him. For a year, they spend every weekend together in Ghent. They think about and write to each other. They speak of their mystical connection. But she is bound to Ghent through incontrovertible family obligations. It's up to Lebel to move to Ghent if he is to marry Marieke. But he is attached to his job in Bruges. There's an exciting opportunity to be a war correspondent. Marieke signals she cannot wait indefinitely. What is Lebel to do? His friend, singer-songwriter Jacques Brel, spoke of ideals, le grand amour, magnificent love, not being sedentary, pursuing noble, dangerous, impossible dreams. But the principles conflict. Afraid to commit to this overpowering love, Lebel chooses his dangerous job, expecting to recoup le grand amour in a year or two. Marieke, however, took this as the end of their relationship. She said, "No more letters, no more communications for a year." Lebel and Marieke part sadly at a train station in Ghent as he heads home and then to Vietnam. One can imagine such a scenario inspiring Jacques Brel to write Orly.
"There are more than 2,000, and I see just these two. The rain binds them, it seems, to one another. There are more than 2,000, and I see just these two. And I know what they say. He must be telling her, 'I love you.' And she must be telling him, 'I love you.' I believe they have to be content to promise each other nothing. These two are too poor to be dishonest. There are more than 2,000, and yet I see only these two." And suddenly, he weeps. He weeps torrents. All around them are the fat, the sweaty, the consumers of hope, who look down their noses. But these two, torn apart, ennobled by their grief, leave to the dogs the act of judging them. Life gives no gifts. And Jesus, it is sad, Orly on Sunday, with or without Mako. And now they weep. I meant to say those two, but it was he I meant when I said they. So intent they are. Each hears nothing more than the sobs of the other. And then endlessly, endlessly, like two bodies at prayer, endlessly, slowly, their two bodies part. And in parting, their two bodies are torn. and I swear to you, they cry. And then they catch themselves and become as one again, become like fire, and then again they're torn and held fast within each other's eyes, and then draw back as the sea withdraws. He closes the farewell, mumbles some words, waves a vague hand, and quickly flies, runs off without another look. And then he disappears, swallowed by a staircase. Life gives no gifts, and Jesus, it is sad, Horley, on Sunday, with or without Bacot. And then he disappears, swallowed by a staircase. And she stays there, heart crucified, mouth wide, without a cry, without a word. She knows her death has come to pass. She turns around. She turns again. Her arms fall down. And then, that's it. For 1,000 years, the door is closed again. Her light is gone. She turns around. And she already knows that she will always turn. She has lost men before. But now, she has lost love, the love she spoke to him, and once again it's useless. She'll live on schemes that will only wait, fragile as always, to be sold again. I am there. I am her. I dare do nothing for her. She whom the crowd devours like a piece of fruit.
Abroad, Lebel longs for Marique. He writes to her several times a week. No reply. He regrets his decision. Months later, still in Asia, Lebel finally receives a laconic letter from Marique, chastising him for breaking their agreement not to write. It announces she's engaged to be married. Irreconcilable peals of contradiction echo in his mind henceforth. She had lost lovers before, but now he has lost love. Shortly after Lebel's return to Ghent, Brel pays him a visit. Lebel can only momentarily conceal his despondency. Surely this is the kind of experience, a universal experience of brotherly love, that caused Brel to write, "Voir un ami pleurer," to see a friend in tears.
It's true there's trouble still in Ireland, and some people lack the gift of song. And though we say no man's an island, America can't right each wrong. It's true there is no smell to money, but we can smell it, have no fears. We trample flowers and think it's funny. But oh, to see a friend in tears. It's true defeats will always find us, and death is sure as day or night. We walk as if we're wearing blinders to where we think we see the light. It's true false lovers leave us sighing, and murdered birds and wasted years. We've given up our dreams of flying. But oh, to see a friend in tears. It's true our towns are devastated by grown-up children, for whose sake we've no more power to abate it than when our lover's teeth may ache. It's true that time steals all our some days. We won't face truth for all our fears, and suicides still ride our subways. And oh, to see a friend in tears. It's true we often shirk our duty. We lack the courage to be Jews. We can't be black for want of beauty, and we're dynamite without a fuse. And since we know all men are brothers, we're not surprised when it appears love makes us slaughter one another. But oh, to see a friend in tears.
Thank you, Sue. My goal today is to help us understand and deal with emotions as perturbances. I will talk about the design of the mind that gives rise to emotion. I'll talk about transcending emotion through first accepting our thoughts and feelings, and second, constructing and pursuing our values. People mean different things by the word emotion, so I will speak in terms of perturbance, which is an essential, uniquely human aspect of emotion. You experience perturbance when one of your inner motivators, a source of value within yourself, becomes very insistent and tends to disrupt your attention such that you would have difficulty controlling your attention if you tried. Perturbance involves motivators, that is, value-laden thoughts or concerns. For example, Jackie was distracted by insistent thoughts of being found out. Lebel kept thinking about Marique, wanting to be with her. They experienced perturbance. Why are you and I susceptible to perturbance? Star Trek, Spock, and Data were emotionless. Could autonomous agents really evolve or be designed that are not subject to emotion as perturbance? Many experts say no, because emotions are necessary mechanisms for survival. However, Professor Aaron Sloman and I say no for a different reason. Emotion as perturbance is not a functional aspect of you or me. It is instead a byproduct of the design of the mind. Perturbance is an emergent state, analogous to the occasional thrashing of a computer's operating system. We tend to think of the mind as a monolithic unit, but we know that the mind is produced by the brain, which is made up of many different areas, themselves composed of billions of neurons. To understand perturbance, we must realize that the mind, like a sandwich, has three very complex layers. Layer one at the bottom, what I refer to as Jackie's emotion machine, was actually her motivation machine. It's a system that generates motivators, again, effectively laden mental content. It makes us evaluate, wish, and want. Layer two in the middle is the management layer, the smarts. It's the part that is in charge of assessing priorities, problem solving, planning, decision making, and taking action. When you play chess or design your budget, the middle layer is hard at work. Now, this part can get distracted by layer one's motivators, telling you, for instance, that it's time for a snack. Layer three at the top is a thin meta-management layer. It's a supervisor that observes the rest of the mind and tries to control thinking. It is very weak in all humans, and weaker still when we're taxed. You are not a single mind. You are a society of mind, as Marvin Minsky put it. The society of mind is not a dictatorship. No layer or component, not even the top layer, has full visibility of or full control over the entire mind. Evolution has ensured that the middle layer, which does all the problem solving, cannot directly disable the bottom layer, the motivation machine. Otherwise, you might choose to stop drinking fluids, for example. You can try to stop drinking fluids, but you can't stop wanting to drink. Examples: a 15-year-old girl starts to smoke. Soon, her motivation machine, the bottom layer, sets up motive generators for smoking. The management layer in the middle is now at the service of these motivators. Her management layer detects that this is a very costly source of motivation. However, top layers cannot simply command the bottom layer, the motivation machine, to be quiet. Similarly, Lebel's perturbance continues for a long time. Everything reminds him of Marique. Irrationally, he keeps wanting to be with her, though the door is closed to the room about which we Unitarians sometimes sing, "Let it be a dance." Elle danse sans lui au milieu des forêts qu'elle dessine, as Francis Cabrel wrote. Lebel longs for his days with Marique. This is grief.
Ay, Marique, Marique, I loved you so. Between the towers of Bruges and Ghent. Ay, Marique, Marique, so long ago. Between the towers of Bruges and Ghent. There is no love, no warm love, whines the wind, the senseless wind. There is no love, no warm love, weeps the sea, the leaden sea. There is no love, no warm love, lies the light, the somber light, and scours the sand over my land, my flat land, my Flanders. Ay, Marique, Marique,
did the Flanders sky, gray as towers in Bruges and Gand. Aye, Marika, Marika, the Flemish sky weeps with me from Bruges to Ghent. There is no love, no warm love, whines the wind that now is gone. There is no love, no warm love, weeps the sea whose tide is run. There is no love, no warm love, lies the light when day is done, and scours the sand over my land, my flat land, my Flanders. I, Marika, Marika, did the Flemish sky hang heavy then from Bruges to Ghent? Aye, Marika, Marika, upon your youth I loved so much from Bruges to Ghent. There is no love, no warm love, laughs the devil, the clever devil. There is no love, no warm love, burns my heart, my aching heart. There is no love, no warm love, mourns the summer, the dying summer, and scours the sand over my land, my flat land, my Flanders. Ay, Marika, Marika, recall the times, recall the times of Bruges and Ghent. Ay, Marika, Marika, recall the times you loved me much from Bruges to Ghent. Ay, Marika, Marika, the evening cools between the towers of Bruges and Ghent. Ay, Marika, Marika, the tidal pools reach out to me from Bruges to Ghent, from Bruges to Ghent, from Bruges to Ghent.
Thank you, Sue. That was beautiful. Lebel tried to suppress his thoughts and feelings about Marique. That is to say, his meta-management layer, that top layer, tried to control the lower layers. But that didn't work. That doesn't work very well. But what does work? Why is it that some people can stop craving a cigarette? Why is it that Jackie was able to deal with her fear, whereas Lebel could not get beyond his grief? How can we handle perturbance when we experience it? Acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT for short, as I'll call it today, provide some answers to these questions. For your information, Russ Harris's book, The Happiness Trap, describes ACT in very simple terms. ACT recognizes that the mind almost continually generates thoughts. It's like there's a radio playing in the background of one's mind. Listening to this homily, your mind may have told you, haven't seen Star Trek for a while. What's the next song? What's this about a motivation machine? I should have married so-and-so. On and on it goes. We tend to assume that our thoughts are significant, but the reality is that our thoughts are often no more worthy of consideration than CNN or than what we think while sleeping. At face value, our thoughts are just thoughts, mental chatter. They're not necessarily true, pertinent, important, or worthy of consideration. To assume that a thought represents reality is called cognitive fusion. Cognitive fusion is the most emotionally harmful cognitive bias we have. Similarly, our motivation machine, that bottom layer of the mind sandwich, generates a lot of motivators, wishes, wants, desires, longings, feelings. We tend to think that these internal motivators are significant. After all, we generated them. But at face value, they are not necessarily worthy of much consideration either. One needs to become skilled at assessing whether a thought is helpful or not. That is a top layer function. But what is one to do if he discovers that a thought is counterproductive? Many self-help frameworks propose actively countering unhelpful thoughts. Lebel thought, I'll never find someone like Marique. So the self-help folk would tell him to counteract that with the opposite thought. There are plenty of Mariques out there. The problem with that strategy is that it declares an internal war that cannot be won. For example, it may very well be that Marique was the best match on earth for Lebel, and Lebel might know that. ACT instead promotes internal peace. ACT says, just recognize your unhelpful thoughts and accept to coexist with them as you might with a neighbor that you don't particularly like. Lebel could say to himself, for instance, oh, thank you, mind, for that useless thought, and then move on. This approach, which overlaps considerably with Buddhism, as you may have noticed, can make a huge emotional difference. Recall that Jackie learned to accept her unhelpful feelings about what Kramer might do. She made room for those feelings, and as a result, they started to seem a lot smaller. They became like small fish in the big pond of her mind. In ACT, however, it does not suffice to accept and diffuse unhelpful thoughts. One needs to have something to replace them with. There's a C in ACT, and that's commitment. But replace them with what? Well, one needs to retreat to decide what is truly important and meaningful to oneself, and then to embrace goals and plans, however big, however small, that accord with one's chosen values. In sum, with ACT, when an insistent, unhelpful motivator surfaces in one's consciousness, one should placidly recognize it as such and redirect one's thinking towards valued motivators and actions. Easier said than done sometimes, but the frameworks I've described today provide research-based tools for redirecting consciousness towards helpful motivators and actions, towards what one's chosen values are. Chosen values. I would love to talk more about values today. It's a fascinating topic at the heart of affect. It's critical to the ACT framework. And one of the most important facts of human life is this. Individual happiness, both as a subjective state and as an objective condition, is largely determined by how well aligned one's thinking and conduct are with one's values. But my time is up. Join us for the humanist meeting next Sunday, where we'll explore values, happiness, and what it means to live a good life. Eventually, motivators related to Marique pulsated more gently in Lebel's mind. But she remained Sedus Moitié, his better half, his divinity, never a means, always an end. A goddess so construed, isolated, if not perturbant, may be healthy. An inspiring abstract entity to whom one dedicates one's valued actions and productions. To paraphrase Willa Cather in the Garden Lodge, Marique's power lay not so much in anything that she actually had, though she had so much, or in anything that she actually was, but in what she suggested, in what she seemed picturesque enough to have or be, and that was just about anything that Lebel chose to believe or to desire. However, what if Marique did come back? Jacques Brel wrote a song referring to a different name, which we can quite liberally interpret as being about that. Let's hear Sue Sparland sing Arnold Johnson's translation of Metzild.
Mama, the time is near again to pray for me in fear again. Matilda is here again. Wine cellar, you can keep your wares. Tonight, I mean, to drown my cares. Matilda is here again. Hey, you, the maid, yes, you, Marie. You'd better change the sheets for me. Matilda is here again. My friends, don't leave me now, I pray. Tonight I jump back in the fray, since damn Matilda's back today. My heart, don't run away. Pretend you didn't hear me say, Matilda is back today. My heart, don't tell me anymore that she's more lovely than before. Matilda, who's back today? My heart stopped swinging like a bell. Remember how she gave you hell? Matilda, who's back today? My friends, don't leave me now, I pray. Remind me I can walk away from damn Matilda any day. And you, my hands, can't you keep still? You know she means to do you ill. Matilda is back again. And you, my hands, stop clapping so. Don't pay attention to her show. Matilda is back again. And you, my hands, stop trembling. Do remember how I wept on you. Matilda is back again. My hands don't open wide again. My arms don't spread to take her in. Matilda is back again. Mama, it does no good to pray. Your Jacques is back in hell today. Matilda's come back to me. Yeah. Wine cellar, bring us all the wares you sell at weddings and at fairs. Matilda's come back to me. And you, the maid, yes, you, Marie, make up the double bed for me. Matilda's come back to me. Depend on me no more, my friends. I'm hoist on my petard again. Sweet Matilda's back again. You're back again.